It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about the causes of the baby formula shortage and get advice from a pediatric nutritionist on what parents can do. First, the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates lately in an effort to combat inflation. But should the Federal Reserve have so much responsibility over our economic well-being? Our guest today argues that the U.S. relies too much on the central banking system, and he offers some solutions for a more stable way to manage the economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the Federal Reserve and the U.S. banking system? Do you support what the Fed has done lately to keep the economy afloat during the pandemic? Do you worry about mission creep since the Great Recession and the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lev Menand is an associate professor of law at Columbia Law School. He's a former U.S. Treasury official. His new book is The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. Lev, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You spent a whole chapter on this, Lev, but let's start with the basics. In a nutshell, what is the Federal Reserve supposed to do? What is its main tool to do it?
Federal Reserve was founded in 1913 to perform a limited purpose, to administer a system of investor-owned chartered banks, banks like J.P. Morgan Chase that we know today, Bank of America, Citigroup, and to ensure that the banking system collectively makes enough money for everybody to use. And the money that banks make are called deposits. Banks issue deposits and they expand and contract their balance sheet. They issue more or fewer deposits by extending loans. And the Fed's job is to ensure that the amount of bank money, the amount of deposits in the economy is sufficient for the economy to operate at full potential. That means maximum employment, price stability, and moderate long-term interest rates in the long run.
We talk sometimes about the Fed's job being to control inflation and to maximize employment and reduce unemployment. As you write it, and as you just said it, that's kind of like a secondary outcome. If they're doing that first thing right, making sure there's the right amount of money in the economy, those other things should, in theory, follow?
That's exactly right. And this is a common misconception throughout Washington, throughout policy debates. The Fed's mission is not employment directly. It's not price stability directly. It's not the Fed's job to ensure that inflation is always 2%. The Fed's job is monetary. It's to ensure that the amount of money in the economy is consistent with long-run stable prices, long-run full employment. And Congress thought when it created the Fed and when it gave the Fed that mission, which was in 1977, that there were a lot of other government agencies who would have to work on things like addressing supply shocks that might cause inflation to be high today or promoting full employment. The Fed's job was monetary. It was a piece of the puzzle, not designed to be the sole macroeconomic agency of the federal government.
Still a pretty big job. But then along comes the financial institutions collapsing that caused the Great Recession. And as you write it and as you chart it, the Fed's job got way, way bigger. What happened?
Yeah. So what happened is over about a 40 to 50 year period, accelerating in the 80s and 90s, the banking system really deteriorated. So the Fed was constructed to manage a system where banks are producing most of the money. Bank deposits are the main monetary instrument. And what you have is the emergence of a shadow banking system, an unregulated set of financial companies that wants to copy the bank business model but not play by the rules, not follow bank regulation. And they emerge and they get quite large. And some of them, listeners will be familiar with, like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, ran into a lot of trouble in 2008. And Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. And these shadow banks by 2008 were playing a major role in the monetary system. But the Fed wasn't designed to administer them, control them, oversee them in the way that it was designed to administer the banking system. And this has just created a world of pain, both for the Fed and for the American people since 2008. And unfortunately, in 2022, we still live in an economy where shadow banks play a major role and the Fed is trying to stabilize them without the right set of tools to do so.
Yeah, and they were kind of improvising tools, you write, back in 2008. What kind of things did the Fed do to extend its toolkit awkwardly to deal with the collapse of some of these shadow banks.
So the Fed aggressively interpreted its legal authorities and set up a variety of ad hoc lending facilities to try to provide the same sort of backstopping that is sort of coded in the law to provide for the banking system, to provide that for the shadow banking system, to ensure that the money, basically, the cash substitutes that the shadow banking system was creating, that those would be exchangeable for cash. So if you think about it, the reason you're willing to hold a deposit instead of government-issued cash is because if you go to your bank, you can get cash for it. There's that that convertibility. And that convertibility, banks are only able to do that because of a whole system the government has set up and the Fed standing behind it, making cash available to banks if they need it. That system doesn't exist for shadow banks. And so the Fed sort of, they jury-rigged a system like that in 2008 so that all of the shadow banks that were issuing their own sort of cash substitutes, there was runs on all of those institutions and they didn't have the cash. And so the Fed tried to make the cash available to them to stop the runs and prevent the entire financial system from basically freezing up.
Talking to Lev Menand about his new book called The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in with your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234 about the role of the Federal Reserve. And do you think Congress should be more at the center of managing economic problems like, say, inflation? Call 800-642-1234. Okay, Lev, the goal here of these improvised tools from the Fed to prevent a full collapse of the financial system, it worked, right? We had a great recession. We didn't have a great depression. So what's wrong with what the Fed did?
So two things. One is there's a qualification on it worked. The Great Recession was great because it didn't actually work that well. We had a much sharper downturn. We had what might be called a hard landing because of the financial system's malfunctions in the fall of 2008. So it took the Fed a while to get the situation under control. The failure of Lehman Brothers and panic in various parts of the financial market meant that credit provisioning froze up, and that meant that hundreds of thousands of people lost their job and ultimately millions lost their homes, a circumstance that was preventable in the sense that this was a product of dysfunction in the monetary and financial system. It wasn't because of a natural disaster like a flood or a pandemic. It was because the system didn't work properly. And that is a catastrophe. And it's an own goal for the U.S. economy. And so the first caveat is it only worked. It worked, but not as well as it should have. The other issue is that the Fed only able to backstop this system when it runs into trouble. And the dynamic effects of that over time are very problematic. The distributional impact leads to financialization, huge financial profits. The financial sector is able to privatize its gains from risk-taking during good times and then turn to the Fed and the government when things go wrong during bad times. And we also have this dynamic now where since the Federal Reserve has put its balance sheet to use in a big way, expanding it trillions of dollars to support this shadow banking system, there's now increasingly demands from across the political spectrum for the Fed to adjust its balance sheet usage to further other social and political goals. So the Fed has really put itself on the map as a major political actor outside of sort of fine-tuning the money system, now that it's clear that it can lend outside the banking system in a big way.
We're talking to Lev Menand, Columbia law professor, author of the new book. We're talking about The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of economic policies would you want to see from a president, from Congress, from the Federal Reserve? Are you worried about growing influence, maybe overreach of the Federal Reserve? Do you think that we need reforms to the banking industry to consider some of these shadow banks our guest is talking about, part of the banking industry? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Columbia Law Professor Lev Menand. His new book is called The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about the Federal Reserve and how we manage our economy, whether there's too much pressure on them to do it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Appleton. Mark, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. So 20 years ago, at the turn of the millennium, the national debt was $5.5 trillion. It's now $30 trillion. The Fed balance sheet was $500 million. It's now $8 trillion. And all of that extra stimulus has worked its way into the financial system to do one thing, and that is to make the economy bigger. My question to your guest is, how will we know when the economy has gotten big enough?
Mark, thanks for the call. Lev?
So the goal of the Federal Reserve is historically to ensure that there's enough money in the economy to allow everybody who wants to work to get a job and all the productive resources of the country to be productively employed. And so economists at the Fed spend their days trying to figure out what the economy's full potential is, how many resources are available, and what would it look like if they were fully employed, all being used. And if they were all being used, how much money would there need to be in the economy? How much money in credit? And are we above or below potential GDP? They create projections, and then they try to set policy as a function of those projections. The actual debt of the government and the actual size of the balance sheet are only indirectly related to the Fed's efforts to ensure that the financial system is creating enough money and credit to keep the economy's resources productively employed. And one thing that we do know is that over the last 15 years, we've not been growing at our full potential, and that we've repeatedly been missing to the downside. And that's part of why many Americans over the last 15 years have perceived the economy as not being as good as the economy that their parents grew up in, and have generally negative perceptions of the economy, because we've actually been missing to the downside year after year.
Mark, thanks for the call. That balance sheet, though, Lev, the Fed and the chart in your book is a really quite impressive, not necessarily a good way, how much more the Fed is holding in various kinds of debt that it's picked up and other things.
Yeah, so historically, up to 2008, the Fed's balance sheet was a sort of passive variable in Fed's policy. It was however big or small it needed to be based on how much physical cash people, ordinary households and businesses in the economy needed to conduct their day-to-day transactions. And so if Americans needed more cash, the Fed would create more physical cash and give that cash to banks, and that's how the cash would enter the system. And so it wasn't used as what we would call a policy variable. Fed officials didn't get together and say, let's grow the balance sheet. It just grew or shrunk based on how much cash people withdrew from banks. Starting in 2008, when the shadow banking system ran aground, the Fed started to expand its balance sheet actively as an active variable in a way that wasn't actually related to how much cash people needed. And so you see the Fed's balance sheet grow from $900 billion, which was mostly about how much cash was in the economy, physical cash, to trillions of dollars. And those dollars were digital dollars. They weren't physical cash circulating in the economy. They were ledger entries on the Fed's books that it used to buy financial assets, securities. And this was a transformation in how the Fed used its balance sheet. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that a lot of this transformation, including a program called quantitative easing, was a byproduct, directly or indirectly, of the Fed's efforts to stabilize the shadow banking system, something that the whole legal framework for money and banking in the U.S. Doesn't sort of anticipate would exist, but does exist, and the Fed needed to figure out some way to keep it from completely imploding.
Thanks for that call, Mark. We'll go to Jim now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Thank you. I'd like to know the role of savings and loans back in the 70s and 80s, especially how were they viewed in this whole scenario about the amount of deposits that they maintained. They were, you know, I remember the 363 rule, and you know, they were the backbone of neighborhood economies. What happened to them with the creation of these investment banks in the 80s?
Jim, thanks for the call. I remember, Lev, the SNL, the savings loan scandals and collapses. Briefly, where do they fit into this picture?
Of course. Terrific question. Mm-hmm. So when I've been using the word banks throughout this call, I've been referring to, there's actually a collection of different chartered banks and different types in this country. And so there are chartered commercial banks like JP Morgan, but there are also savings and loans, thrifts that are federally chartered. And there are thrifts that are state chartered, and there are credit unions, and all of those entities maintain deposits. And so all those deposits are part of the money supply. They're part of the instruments people use to store value and to conduct exchanges. And so the thrifts are part of the banking system. And up until the 90s, we had a very diffuse, decentralized banking system. So we had thousands of commercial banks, we had thousands of thrifts, and we had thousands of credit unions. And there wasn't like one or two huge ones that dominated. The savings and loans crisis of the 1980s was a function of a number of things, but one of them was regulatory differences between the thrift system and the banking system, and regulatory competition, loosening of standards. So managing within the banking system has historically been a problem. The rise of shadow banking has interjected a whole new dimension. Because here's a new competitor for all of the different bank types that we have under the legal regime that's not even within the sort of traditional legal framework for banking. And so the 90s and the aughts are the story of the emergence of all these other types of entities, as well as a sort of related change in the law of how the regulated banking system worked that allowed for conglomeration. And so you have the emergence of major financial conglomerates and very, very large banks, and the concentration of the banking system in the 2000s and the 90s. And nowadays, thrifts are a much smaller part of the monetary system than they were in the 80s, just as the banking system itself is a smaller part of the monetary system. Mm-hmm. In about 2007, 2008, half the sort of money supply was shadow bank money. So deposits were much, much smaller part of the money supply than they used to be.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Lev Menand about his new book, The Fed Unbound. Lev, I want to take our last few minutes and look at solutions. One solution you really point to is Congress taking a more active role in using other kinds of tools. I want to get one, for instance. You talk about options for Congress in dealing with the kind of inflation we're seeing nowadays. What kind of things could you see Congress and the president doing to tackle some of the causes of inflation?
So obviously, monetary tightening is part of addressing certain types of price rises. But we shouldn't look to the Fed exclusively to address inflation, because inflation has a lot of causes, oftentimes non-monetary causes, and the Fed's tools are very blunt. We would be much better off as a society if we could address inflation in a more narrow way, rather than slowing down the entire economy so that supply and demand equilibrate, address areas where supply and demand is specifically out of whack. So there's a couple ways to do this. One is through fiscal tightening. So Congress can raise taxes in areas that are overheating. It can also reduce its own spending in areas of the economy that are overheating. I also think the United States should have industrial policy again. And so there are certain sectors of the economy where supply and demand are out of whack. Healthcare has experienced enormous inflation. Energy has experienced inflation. Housing experiences inflation. So rents are up and housing prices are way up. And the federal government should have a national plan for those sectors of the economy to increase supply, to bring prices back down again. And that's something that Congress used to be more engaged with. And it would be to everybody's benefit, I think, for Congress to turn to that again, as well as to the executive branch, so that we try to increase the capacity of the economy in order to get out of inflation rather than reducing economic growth to slow inflation, which makes everybody worse off than the alternative.
And in just our last minute, Lev, the shadow banking industry, these bank-like things that aren't regulated like banks, what would you like to see happen?
We have to rationalize our bank regulatory system. In insurance, if you issue a product that looks like insurance, that talks like insurance, that walks like insurance, insurance regulation applies. In securities regulation, same thing. You can't issue stock securities and call them something else and not follow the securities laws. In banking, for far too long, you've been able to copy the bank business model, say you're not doing banking, and not have to follow the banking laws. That has to stop. Fundamentally, we have to change the law so that any entity that does something that looks like banking follows the same rules as all the other entities doing something that looks like banking.
Lev, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lev Menand is an associate professor of law at Columbia Law School, a former U.S. Treasury official, and author of the new book, The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. He's with us today looking at ways to reform our economic system to be less reliant, he says, on the Federal Reserve. Coming up after news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, 40% of baby formula is out of stock in the U.S. A reporter tells us why, then a pediatric nutritionist tells us what parents can do if they're having a hard time finding these formulas in their area. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the technology industry is hitting a rare financial decline. We'll find out what might be causing it, what impact it could have, and whether another bubble is bursting. Now, there's a major shortage of baby formula in the U.S. right now. About 40% of baby formula just isn't on the shelves. The shortage was triggered by the closure of a plant in Michigan earlier this year. But why would the closure of one plant cause such a big shortage in the first place? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your life right now? Are you a parent in need of baby formula? Has the shortage impacted you, or have you been able to find it in store on store shelves? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Colin Lodewick is a writing fellow at Fortune, where he reports on work and the economy. Colin, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, of course. Thank you for having me on.
Well, the center of this story, this plant in Michigan, an Abbott Nutrition plant, had to pull a product connected to infant deaths because of contamination. Remind us what was going on there.
Yeah, so to understand what's happening, you kind of have to go back to fall of last year. Between September 2021 and February 2022, there were reports of four illnesses, like you said, and two deaths in infants that were linked to baby formula produced at this single plant owned by Abbott in Sturgis, Michigan, and a bacteria called Chronobacter sakazaki. In response to those reports, the company voluntarily recalled its products on February 17th and began its own investigation into the potential contamination. In line with its own investigation, the FDA also had its own investigation, which it started on January 31st, but that didn't complete until March 16th. Chronobacter is a pretty common bacteria, and Abbott found it during its investigation, later said that using genomic sequencing, the bacteria that it found did not correspond to the strain that was linked to those infant deaths and illnesses. The FDA, through their investigation, found other compliance issues that kind of go beyond the specific issue with this bacteria, including workers at the plant not wearing proper protective gear, things like that. So as a result, the plant is still shut down. And yeah, that's kind of where things are right now and what has happened.
So why is the closure of one plant having such a big impact overall? You might think, well, it's just one factory.
Yeah, of course. So the thing is, baby formula is an extremely, extremely tightly regulated industry. Like in terms of the Food and Drug Administration, it sort of falls more on the drug side just because there are so many specific things that have to go into formula. And as a result, the companies that have the most resources have been able to dominate the industry for years. The most recent numbers that I have from 2011, I believe, from a USDA report said that Abbott had a 43% share of the market. Little has changed since then. Another factor contributing is the fact that these major manufacturers are able to enter into exclusive contracts with the USDA's Supplemental Nutrition Program for Low-Income Families. Its nickname is WIC. And when it has a contract with WIC, it basically, you know, contributes or provides baby formula for low-income families in an entire state. Based on numbers that I have, Abbott provides baby formula for approximately half of WIC participants.
Now, we've got this shortage. You talked to some people in your reporting and asked your readers to share stories. What kind of things did you hear from people as they try to scramble to find formula?
Yeah, so people across the country are, you know, feeling the shortage, feeling very desperate. Something that I've been hearing again and again is how people are spending hours and days driving between different locations trying to find any formula on the shelves. A lot of the times parents rely on a, you know, specific type of formula that works best for their child. And then when they are not able to find that specific formula, they kind of are reticently switching to other formulas that maybe might be, maybe their children don't respond to as well. I've also heard a lot from grandparents who are, you know, because their children maybe are working parents, don't have the time to be going store to store. So they're the ones kind of taking up the extra effort along with, you know, other family members or friends. I've also, you know, been hearing reports of people using alternative formulas, homemade formulas, you know, that is widely recommended to not happen. You know, pediatricians across the country say do not use homemade formula, but when people are being pushed to sort of desperate measures, that's like, you know, one kind of avenue that it seems like people turn to. And then when people are not able to access formula at all, there are also reports that they're, you know, watering down formula, just, you know, stretch the last can a couple more days. So, you know, I think a lot of people are kind of at their wit's end with what's going on.
In just a few minutes, we'll hear from a Wisconsin nutritionist with recommendations on what to do and not to do, including a couple of things that Colin mentioned readers were doing. Colin Lodewick is with us from Fortune, where he reports on work and the economy, looking at this baby formula shortage around the United States, causes and possible solutions. And let's turn to that now. Colin, Abbott reached a deal with the FDA to reopen its plant. I'm guessing this doesn't mean that they're going to have product ready to hit the shelves tomorrow.
Yeah, of course. So that agreement actually still needs to be approved by a court in Michigan. And, you know, once it does, which could take a couple weeks, it'll take an additional 6 to 8 weeks before Abbott products actually end up on store shelves.
So that's that plant. Looking around the country, the other companies, the other plants that make infant baby formula, are they able to spin their production up to help make up some of the shortfall?
Yes, the FDA has reported that it's been, you know, in talks with all these other major players, including Nestle and Mead Johnson, in order to ratchet up their own production of formula.
And then how about importing formula from other countries?
I believe on Monday, the Biden administration announced that it would start to, you know, the FDA has very strict requirements for importing formula into the United States, but on Monday, Biden announced that he would ease some of those requirements to make it easier for foreign product to get into the U.S.
And are people talking about... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I also want to say that Abbott has said that it is attempting to also import product from its facility in Ireland, you know, to help mitigate the crisis.
Now, are people... These are shorter-term solutions. Are people talking about changes that need to be made so in future, if there's a contamination at one plant, it doesn't create a crisis like this?
You know, that's an interesting question. I actually haven't really been seeing any solutions for what might happen going forward besides, you know, more stringent requirements at, you know, different plants when they detect potential contamination, things like that. But in terms of, you know, breaking up monopolies or making it easier for competitors to get into the market, it seems like that is a conversation that's more difficult to have and probably, you know, further off in the future.
And Colin, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next on this story?
I am, you know, talking with as many parents as I can. I have, I believe, you know, 3 calls set up today with mothers who, you know, can't get formula still. I think I am interested to see if, you know, Abbott says that it'll take 6 to 8 weeks to get formula back on store shelves. I'm wondering if things will get a lot worse until then, or if maybe the other efforts that the FDA, the government, and Abbott are taking will start lessening the crisis over the next couple of weeks.
Colin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Colin Lodewyk is a writing fellow at Fortune, where he reports on work and the economy. He talked to us about the ongoing baby formula shortage, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to hear from a Wisconsin pediatric dietitian. We want to hear from you if you use this formula, if you are able to find it. If you are, great. We'd love to hear about that, that things are going well for you. If you've had trouble, if you've had to switch brands or switch stores to be able to find it, what are you seeing out there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about a baby formula shortage. We're going to get some advice from a Wisconsin dietitian now. Still time to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Parents and grandparents, what are you seeing out there if you rely on this formula? Are you finding it on store shelves easily, switching brands, or just flat out having trouble finding a source? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you work with infants as a pediatrician in healthcare or other services, what are you hearing from your patients, your clients? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Hey, if you work at a store that sells this stuff, are the shelves empty or you got a pretty good supply? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Camilla Martin is a pediatric registered dietitian at UW Health. Camilla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with something we just heard from Colin, who's been reporting on this. Some of the parents he's talked to have said they're watering down the formula, diluting it more. I understand that's not a great solution. Can you talk about that?
Exactly. So the issue with watering down formula is because us as adults, our bodies have the ability to process nutrients and things that come in really different ways. We have a much more advanced just body as a whole and gut. So it's the kidneys that filter water. And if we're diluting down formula, it's making it more concentrated with water. And for an infant, their kidneys are not actually able to process that. So it can be quite dangerous and has resulted in hospitalizations and even infant deaths. So that's why we strongly encourage not watering down formula if a family is able to do that.
And then Colin also mentioned you heard for people looking for online recipes for formula. What are the problems we run into there?
So many of these recipes are coming from the 50s, 60s, before we had the FDA's tightly regulated system that Colin had mentioned. So these recipes, similar to watering down formula, can be very dangerous. Our body has the ability to break down different nutrients as they come in. For us as adults, if we have a day where we don't eat as well as maybe we should have, our body's still able to process that in a safe way. But for an infant, their body isn't able to break things down. So proteins that it's not able to break down can be left undigested in the gut and can be quite dangerous and can lead to things like GI bleeds or malabsorption or just other issues that are really dangerous for infants.
Okay, those are a couple things to avoid. Let's talk about things that we can do now. A lot of brands are out of stock, but there might be other brands. How big a deal is it in most cases for parents of infants to switch to a brand that maybe they haven't been used to using?
I'm really glad you brought this up because, as Colin has mentioned, this has been these supply issues have been something that we've been dealing with in our pediatric specialty clinics for a good 6 months now. So we're handling these questions every day. Each formula company has different levels of different types of formula. A lot of them will use language that makes it seem like one is maybe better than the other. And some may be better tolerated for one child versus another. However, many formulas will have an alternative to a formula that a family is not able to find. So it is perfectly safe, and it is within that FDA tightly regulated system. So it's perfectly safe to switch from one brand of formula to another. If an infant or child is particularly sensitive, occasionally we'll recommend to our families that they make a smaller batch of formula according to the directions on the can. It is okay to mix them to provide a more gradual transition. Otherwise, if a baby is fed from a bottle, we've had them switch every other feed. However, if they don't have some of that previously well-tolerated formula, it is okay to switch directly from one brand to another. That is perfectly safe and will be a much better option than watering down formula, and can also make formula much more accessible. I'm working with families, and Colin mentioned stories for some of the individuals he's interviewing, for them having to drive hours to different stores to find a new formula. That can be really, really challenging to families that have difficulty accessing safe, reliable transportation with the rising cost of gas prices. So switching to an alternative brand can be perfectly safe and can make some of that stress a bit relieved to find something that's closer by.
Now, for patients, for parents who can't find a formula for their kids and, you know, maybe not don't have the wherewithal or, you know, their parents, the time to drive all over the county looking for formula, what kind of options out there? What kind of resources might be out there for them to get at least a temporary holdover batch?
So first, I would recommend finding an alternative brand that might be available at their local store. Each formula company uses slightly different language to differentiate what's standard versus sensitive versus comfort, soothe, or gentle. If they do feel comfortable navigating that language on their own, it is okay to switch to any other standard formula if that's what their infant or child was on previously. So that can be the easiest and can avoid some of that extra driving around. If a family has questions on that, I recommend that they reach out to their primary physician's office to help differentiate which one might be best for their infant, especially if they've had issues tolerating different types before. Otherwise, if they're working in like a pediatric specialty clinic with access to a registered dietitian, this is kind of the bread and butter of a lot of the things that we do. So we can provide an alternative. If they aren't able to find something in the stores, we're recommending that families look to an online major retailer, like any of the major companies directly through their own website can be a good first option. Through like a certified Amazon retailer can be another option. Major stores like the Targets, the Walmarts, the Walgreens, the CVSs, good on the list. You can oftentimes purchase things online. So we would recommend starting there. If they're still not having luck with that, then we'd recommend utilizing their support system. Social media groups can be a great resource. I've heard of families who have the time and ability to go from store to store and are taking videos of what's in different stores. So there might be information on where to find information there or to find formula there. Because of the extra media attention, it's been really helpful that more people are talking about it. So reaching out to caregivers of infants and children that are dependent on formulas, they might be able to find something at a store near them before the parent is having to drive from place to place. I would caution families against purchasing formula if it's not from an authorized retailer. If it's from a social media group or a Craigslist or from like a foreign website, we don't have the regulations like we would over the major retailers. So there's no way to guarantee that it's not expired or recalled or was held at a temperature that could make it go bad. Also, if that formula is impacted by a recall in the future, if it's through a major retailer, lots of times families can get a reimbursement for that. You can't do that if it's from a family member or support system. So that can be a good resource, but we're definitely cautioning our families to make sure that it's from a safe source.
We're talking to Camilla Martin, pediatric registered dietitian at UW Health, looking at a shortage of formula for infants around the country and some advice. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Fran is with us in La Crosse. Fran, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious because I haven't heard this discussed before on the program tonight. Just wondering about women who are able to breastfeed and if this shortage might encourage those who are able to that haven't before to do so. It's free. It's accessible for those women who can breastfeed. And I don't want to shame those who do use formula because, of course, for medical reasons and other reasons, there are women who just aren't able to breastfeed and do need to rely on formula. But I'm just wondering if your guest could comment on that.
Fran, thanks for the call. Camilla?
Yeah, I'm really glad this topic came up because that's a big part of my role as well. We've been really focusing on formula. But as a certified lactation specialist working with families increasing or making it increasing their ability to breastfeed is another big piece of what I do. Breast milk is an excellent source of nutrition. It's really kind of the gold standard for infants. So if a family is able to provide their infant breast milk, we would absolutely encourage that. And there's lots of different lactation resources around the community within a family's healthcare system. Generally, there will be a breastfeeding specialist available there. There's oftentimes breastfeeding specialists available through a local WIC office, the Women, Infants, Children program that Colin had mentioned, which, as a side note, is also a great resource for good information on alternative formula and obtaining formula that I didn't mention before. There's other community-based organizations like La Leche that will have presence in most communities. There's different organizations that you might be able to find in your local area. In Dane County, we have a wonderful resource in the African American Breastfeeding Alliance that partners with the Harambe Village Doulas, Roots for Change that partners with Centro Hispano. There's a clinic called Today, Not Tomorrow. So there's quite a few breastfeeding resources that are available. And if a family is struggling to provide enough breast milk, they're having issues with it being painful, supply is an issue, we would definitely encourage them to reach out to those resources to help make that a little bit easier and more feasible. However, unfortunately, this is not always something that's possible for families to provide due to, as the caller mentioned, medical issues with not enough paid family leave, with not being provided sufficient breaks. So there are issues that can interfere with that. So that's when formula can be a good backup. And that's when we get into all of these alternatives that we've been discussing.
Fran, thanks for the call. Aaron joins us now in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I think this is related to the last caller's question, but I was just curious what awareness and communication is going on with people giving birth right now at hospitals or birthing centers? You know, because if people are on the fence of, am I going to try the breastfeeding route? Am I going formula? Knowing that there's a shortage, I think, can inform people's decision. And so I was just wondering what kind of communication and awareness is being done with people giving birth or are pregnant right now.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Camilla?
That's a great question. So that's outside of the area that I currently work in. However, most local birthing centers will have their own breastfeeding class that could be maybe partnered with a childbirth class or could be on its own. Quite a few of those organizations that I mentioned that can provide lactation support after an infant is born will also have classes or resources for a family to get informed on how to go about breastfeeding their infant. So I would encourage them to utilize those resources. Again, the WIC program is a really excellent resource for breastfeeding information from breastfeeding specialists, as well as a variety of different handouts and pamphlets and information to help a family prepare.
Thanks for that call. And Camilla, thank you so much for sharing the advice and resources with us today.
Absolutely.
Camilla Martin is a pediatric registered dietitian at UW Health. She told us about resources for parents amid the major baby formula shortage going on right now. I'll just say, as an adoptive parent of twins back in the day, we relied pretty heavily on formula. So my thoughts are with you if you're trying to deal with this. Good luck to you. Hope you can find what you need out there. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, the pesticide DDT was sold as a miracle weapon against mosquitoes, but it caused massive ecological damage, driving bald eagles and other bird species to the brink of extinction. Look, the rise, fall, and possible return of DDT with the author of the new book, How to Sell a Poison. And as always, you can join in with your questions and your thoughts. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I had a meal with sweet potato the other day, which I like, but the question came up, what's the difference between a sweet potato and yam? Is there a difference? Are they the same thing? The real answer, they are not the same thing. The answer in stores, yeah, sometimes they are. I looked this up on Epicurious and some other cooking sites. Here's the quick deal. Sweet potatoes and yams, they are different things. They're not even closely related. Sweet potatoes in the morning glory family, yams are closer to palms and grasses. Quick way to tell them apart, sweet potatoes, smooth-skinned, generally reddish-brown, they taste, you know, sweet. Yams, rougher-skinned, they look like tree bark, they're starchier. But at some point in American history, people started calling sweet potatoes yams. And the FDA, they don't care what you call them. So grocery stores often label their sweet potatoes as yams. So no wonder I'm confused. I am what I am. This is Central Time.